It has many names: Santa Ana, Scirocco, Chinook, and it beholds to no season. Coming unbidden at high noon in summer or in the darkness of a winter's eve, the weather vane trembles and then suddenly pivots to point dead opposite. The white-capped ocean calms, waiting, as an oppressive blanket of air moves downslope and spreads over the two cities at the mouth of the river. Winter turns to summer, and summer becomes just a step away from hell's back door. The cooling fog flees seaward, fading like a ghost. Now the heat holds a small section of coastline in a firm grip. Heat and something else, the Chetco effect. Tonight's story, Eli Beckett, The Case of the Missing Brother, is to be viewed only in black and white. Noir meets Buck Rogers, if you will. Just another tale of the strange goings-on in our little hamlet, when the heat envelops it from time to time. Sometimes it feels like California. Maybe it's the proximity, maybe it's something else. And make no mistake, I could go back. The border's a mere 6 miles south, and I could walk there if I had to. 5 years it's been, and I've never done anything other than stand on this side of it. Looking south, but never going any further than that. Feeling like Moses must have felt when he looked upon the promised land, knowing that it was forever denied him. Paco once said to me, "It gets inside you, man. You leave it, but it never leaves you." He may have been right. Probably he was right, though he never lived long enough to see the proof of it. I look out my office window above the main drag. On a hot night like this, the traffic below could be from where I once was instead of where I am now. For all I know, it's the same heat. It's just rising from a different tarmac. Voices floating up from a different sidewalk could be having the same conversations. The bright cold moon shines here as well as there, and the shadows it casts all point in the same direction. But this is not there, and I've not spoken to Elena since. My last remembrance of her, turning away from me, tears on her cheeks, bending the light from the setting sun. Shoulders already shaking from the sobs I refused to hear. Me turning away for the last time, in my anger thinking that it was only she that I was hurting. One story below, the traffic moves. The people converse, and yes, the heat flows up off the pavement. The moon, setting itself down on the ocean's edge, shines a cold light across this, not California. In the distance, music plays from a cheap radio. I can just make out the melody of a song floating out from some window open to let the heat out, or just to let the world in. Too distant to make out the words, but still my mind supplies him. "Against the wind," he laments. It echoes down the canyon that rives my soul, and I wonder, how can it be that he knows my life so very, very well? I turn away from the window and go to sit at my desk, staring into the gloom, waiting to see if this hot night will bring anything other than remorse. In the distance, heat lightning plays against the hillside, reflecting Rorschach images against the far wall. Thunder rolls down to the sea, an unsteady heartbeat in the night. The moon sets, pulling darkness behind it. The minutes tick by. It's 3 a.m., and the traffic is as gone as if it had never been. Not that it was ever heavy to begin with, not this time of year. The locals have their town back, and the tourists avoid winter here like the plague. They're not in on the secret. The summer sometimes visits in the dead of winter. That the storms apart to go past as if the city were shielded by an invisible wedge. Somewhere between the tourists and the locals are the ones who are just passing through. Perhaps itinerant, perhaps a drug habit that precludes steady employment. A piece of cardboard, a weary dog, and a hand held out for sustenance. Be it for food or money, or just to place a needle in their veins. False independence on the perimeter of society. Dirty sea foam at tide's edge. We all have a drug. We all need a fix. Sometimes it's the lies we feed ourselves. And here am I, a 5-year rest stop, because the highway behind won't let go. Anchored, yet still adrift. My office gives off the day's heat, slowly, slowly popping and creaking. Timbers as old as the city itself. Rough-hewn beams that will outlast everything save a great burning. The promise of rain from the earlier storm has been revoked. The clouds thinning and now gone. The lightning, a memory. Quiet owns the streets. and even the waves have gone to calm. No more than a gentle lapping against the shore, they can't overcome the silence, the no sound that only darkness can make. Brief intervals, patiently waiting for the end of the universe, when silence will reign forever. Tick tock, tick tock. In the distance, a car. Who besides myself would be up at this hour? Intrigued, for this town always sleeps at night, I return to the window. A welcome retreat from memory, a momentary break from the ennui. A sleek, expensive shape, catching highlights from the street lamps, and then tossing them back. A low, purring growl, the kind that only money can afford. Slowing and then pulling over to a stop. Many places to park under a street lamp, but the driver chooses the darkest spot. A kindred spirit, I think, but quickly lose that idea when the occupant exits. Walking with determination, pulling the expensive hat down to cover her eyes when she moves under a street lamp's revealing cone of light. Walking down Main Street, as lithe and supple as any panther. She owns the night and knows it. A dress so blue it's almost black. Dark and clinging, a shadowy, indigo promise, cut just low enough. A sleek, expensive shape. Beauty, just another bankable asset. A subtle scent comes all the way up to my window, and for a moment I think of the future instead of the past. I've never met her, though I immediately know who she is. As anyone in this city would. As anyone in this country likely would. The car, the sheer confidence. It's old money. Money that, in a way, did grow on trees. Redwoods, cedars, and firs. The turn of the last century, when this town smelled of freshly cut timber and the wood-fired trains that hauled it in. The shadows of powerful men stretching across the decades. Men who came and saw the wealth and cut the forest down to grasslands, turning it into pasture for sheep and cattle, interest on wealth already accrued. Now of late, forest again, waiting for the next baron to rob it of its green wealth. Old money, handed down from generation to generation, and forced grown into piles bigger than the trees from whence it came. The rich get richer, I think, and to do that, the poor must get poorer. It angers me, that thought, and the image of Paco, it returns to my mind. I start to turn away from the window, but the tap of heels stop below. A second later, the buzzer on the downstairs door rings, insistent, because she's not used to being kept waiting. I ignore it. And again, and once more, she rings. A pause, and then again. She waits a moment, and then steps away from the door. To leave, I think, but no, she stops and looks up at the window. I know you're up there, Mr. Beckett. I set my jaw and wait for her to give up. She steps to the door and rings the bell yet again. She isn't going to give up. It's in the set of her shoulders, in the strands of her DNA. Shrugging, I hit the button beside my desk and sit down and wait. Wait for one Miss Morgan Duquesne. Perhaps the richest woman on the West Coast, about to enter my humble office. So much for the ennui. You're Eli Beckett, private investigator. It's not a question. That's what it says on the door you just came through, Morgan. Her chin goes up a notch, and then she stops herself, and there's a moment of fright in those beautiful seafoam eyes. Fright and vulnerability, so fleeting that I'm not even sure I saw it. Find it hard to believe it could even be there in that face. So what? Yeah, she's beautiful and she's rich. If she wants to send some of that money my way, I'll listen. Make the rich a little less richer. And for the poor, a brief moment of success. A little less dirty sea foam at tide's edge. I nod toward the chair in front of my desk. She continues to stand. I shrug and return her gaze. The silence stretches. I can do this all night. Similar DNA, I suppose. A hint of a smile as she sits. I feel like I just lost a contest I didn't even know I was in. I need your help, Mr. Beckett. She glances at her watch. I don't have a lot of time. The power's only going to be down a few minutes. I'm thrown, but cover it with witty repartee. Huh? The power outages we've been having these past 2 weeks, surely you've noticed. Exasperated. Why are you here, Ms. Duquesne? She holds up a finger. One more minute, Mr. Beckett. I hope, that they're too busy to pay attention to what I'm doing, that they're too busy with the power. Lady, you aren't making a lot of sense, and in case you hadn't noticed, it is after my usual hours. I know all about your hours, Mr. Beckett. That's why I'm here right now. The fun suddenly goes out of it. I feel like the losing piece in a game of mess with the little people. The rich and the famous, slumming and laughing behind their hands at the rest of us. I stand up. I'm not known for my patience. This meeting, or whatever it is you think you're doing here, is... The lights go out. Not even a flicker. Her voice in the dark. Good. Right on time. I need you to find out something for me. Her voice is a low contralto, and it doesn't seem shaken at all by the sudden darkness, nor her ability to know the moment it would happen. I would think it a ruse, something she has engineered, but the darkness is complete. There's nothing from the outside. Street lamps, porch lights, nothing. It's ebony out there. How did you know the power was going down? I'll get to that, she responds. As I said, we don't have a lot of time. There's someone I need you to find. She pauses. No, that's not right. I need you to find where someone is going. I only work in town, I respond. If someone's leaving, you're on your own. I wish it were that easy. There's something going on I don't understand. I followed it myself, and then it's hard to explain. You followed someone in this town and lost them? Yes, twice in the very same spot. Okay, I'll bite. How? She sounds embarrassed. That's what's so hard to explain. She takes a deep breath. I fell asleep. That makes no sense. No, Mr. Beckett, it doesn't. But all I can say is I was following him, doing my best not to be detected. Then suddenly I was overcome with exhaustion. I barely had a chance to pull over before I fell asleep. Not for long, less than a minute, but when I awoke, he was gone. I look at her, or rather where her voice is. It's still pitch black. If the lights hadn't gone out, I'd have told her to get the hell out of my office. But there's something in her voice, something only the dark might reveal. Truth. Okay, I'm listening. It's my brother, Mr. Beckett. Jeremiah Duquesne. Her voice trails off, and now I think her eyes are probably showing that same vulnerability I saw before, maybe even glistening with unshed tears. Go on, I say, softer than I intended, and I'm immediately angry with myself. I'm nobody's sucker, I think, and that pings against a 5-year-old memory. Now maybe it's me with unshed tears. I push it aside. Anger's a warmer fire. Mr. Beckett, you aren't going to believe me, and I'm not sure I would either. I let my impatience through. Spill it or leave. Now I mock her. We've only got a few minutes. Her confidence seems to return, not something I suspect that is ever too far away, and with it her own undertone of anger. My brother's mind is being controlled, Mr. Beckett. That's the only way I can explain it. I'm an idiot, I think to myself. Played the fool for late-night amusement. A footnote to the lives of the rich and famous. A prize in a rich person's scavenger hunt. Go play your rich game somewhere else, lady, before I toss you out on your ass. I hear her stand, the rustle of that clingy, dark blue dress. I think she's going to leave, but then I hear the clasp of her purse open. Then another sound, one I'd recognize anywhere. Crisp bills, one after another, being laid down on my desk. These aren't ones, minor voice schools me. She wouldn't sully her hands with that denomination. The gentle slap-slap goes all the way up to 10. I hear her sit back down. Another sound, a manila envelope landing on my desk. $1,000, Mr. Beckett. Everything you need to know is in that envelope. I can't stay much longer. The power's about to come on. And like magic, it does. Almost, I tell her to go to hell. Almost. But as a singer once said, I stuff the bills in my shirt. She stands and looks down at me. That's for one day's work, Mr. Beckett. I'm hiring you for 7. If you find out where my brother's going, I'll double the 7 days' pay. She bends over my desk and writes down a number and a time on my notepad. I try to keep my eyes on her face. Call me at that number tomorrow, she says, standing up. Make sure it's exactly at that time. I know the answer, but I ask anyway. Because the power will be down, right? That is absolutely right, Mr. Beckett. Good night, or should I say, good morning. A gentle rustle of cloth, and then she's gone. A few moments later, the purr of expensive metal, and then silence. All that's left is the subtle hint of a perfume meant for arousal, meant for control. I growl to myself and go to bed. It's all there in the manila envelope, now sitting on my passenger seat. Her brother's picture, his car make and license number, and what time he'll leave the house. And a list of times with power outages written above it. A week of varying times beyond the one annotated for last night. Then nothing beyond that other than a bad feeling. Clipped to it all, another 500. For expenses, it says. The writing is feminine as a sway of her hips. It's pulling me in and I don't like it. I can feel the hook setting, because it would seem I've already swallowed the worm. I slam the shifter into reverse and back out of my parking place a little too fast. I'm angry, but the problem is, I don't know at whom. It's too hot for December, and that fuels my anger as well. As I drive down Chetco Avenue, all the decorations seem out of place. Christmas in July, it screams, though Santa's just a couple of weeks from leaving the North Pole. Why do I feel like all we're going to get in our stockings this year is coal? Dark and as black as midnight in a city without power. I swing through Mickey D's, breakfast, or as the rest of the world calls it, a late lunch. A couple large coffees, black of course, and then north as if I'm leaving town. Fat chance. I go just past the Carpenterville turnoff, then pull over onto the shoulder. I pull out my cell phone, pretending to make a call. A perfect excuse for being parked here at the side of the road. I have a clear line of sight to the highway, as well as the turnoff in my rearview mirror. If I'm to believe what she's written down for me, Jeremiah Duquesne will be coming along in about 10 minutes to make the turn onto Carpenterville. I've already downed one of the large coffees and am nursing the second one. I don't believe any of her story about falling asleep, but I'm already 1,000 richer. 1,500 if you count the go money, and I'm taking no chances. The day's already too hot, and I drop my window. No good. I drop the passenger side as well, hoping for a cooling breeze, but everything's still. Even the road. Little traffic this time of year, or this time of day. 1,500. I could go back to California with that kind of money. Leave right now if I wanted. Find Elena, maybe try to patch it up. But there's that inner voice. 5 years, it says. 5 years. Do you really think she's still waiting for you to show? Do you really believe those tears were for you? Or were they for opportunity lost? Wasted time on her part. Was it really you that she was crying over? Or Paco? And what would have happened if you had stayed? You know it, Beckett. Time to face the truth, to quit wallowing in your own lies. It was done before you were left. It was done when Paco took a bullet. It was done before he hit the ground. And that would have always been there between us. Had always been there, I suddenly realized. A third person in the relationship. A silent voyeur in the same room. Cut it off quick and clean, I'd said to myself, and damned if I hadn't been right. Pull off the Band-Aid and let the healing begin. Why is it then I keep pulling stitches out of an old wound? I shut that inner voice down to concentrate on what I'm doing, or maybe because I don't like the story it's telling me. Either way, I've got a job, and if I'm to believe her, he's on his way. I hear him just before I see the vehicle, recognizing it from her description, a tricked-out black Hummer with a tinted windshield. Not loud, but like the car's sister drives, there's that same low thrum of power. I can't see him behind the windshield. Can't see if his face is as blank as she says it always becomes every time the power goes down. He begins to slow for the turnoff, going much too slow, I think, and then realize that it's not him. It's me. Lethargy slowing my perception. I try to suppress a yawn, but it escapes anyway. Stakeouts, I lie to myself. A long night and a short sleep, knowing it's wrong even as I think it. I don't like this, how right she is. And then I think something else. Some thought that I grasp at as I'm suddenly spiraling down into a deep, dark hole. The power's out here, too, says a deep, disembodied voice. Then a fleeting image of Elena, staring at me. Accusatory, except that it's not Elena. It's Morgan Duquesne wearing that same dark blue dress she wore last night. A dress Elena could never have afforded. I have just a moment to see Jeremiah Duquesne's turn signal come on, and then the hole closes, and I'm as out as the power. We're at Chetco Point Park, the little beach on the mostly north side with all the rocks. If you climb around carefully enough, you can be hidden from the ocean as well as the land. How was your beauty sleep, Mr. Beckett? Ineffectual, I respond. A small, crooked smile and then nothing more. She's leaning against one of the boulders, looking for all the world like a photo shoot from some glamour magazine. Today she's coast casual, jeans, flip-flops, and a tank top covered by a short-sleeved blouse that ties at the front. No less alluring than the dress she was wearing during our last meeting. No perfume that I can discern, though she has her own scent, and I do my best to ignore it. The hot wind plays with her hair. Okay, I believe you, I say. I had enough coffee in me to keep a bull elephant up for 24 hours. I went out like a light. Just for a minute, like you said, but down and deep. Why do you think it affects just the people who are trying to tell my brother? It doesn't. This time it's her turn to be surprised. What do you mean? I mean that when I woke up, I wasn't the only car at the side of the road. Whatever it is, it was very localized. There were two more cars pulled over. I watched. Both drivers looked surprised and then shrugged it off and left. Her voice cracks a bit. What am I going to do? I can't follow him. If I hadn't got suspicious, hadn't searched his desk when he was out, I never would have found those times. Wouldn't have had any reason to try to follow him. She looks at me, and now I do see vulnerability. He's the only family I have, Eli. When my parents died, I had to raise him, take over the business, and keep the sharks away all at the same time. It was hard, but I made it happen. He's more a child to me than a brother. I can't bear if something... She's close to tears. Why do you think this is happening to him? I ask, changing the topic. There's gratitude in her eyes, and I look the other way. She's a lot smarter than I ever would have thought. I don't know, she says after a moment. I can only guess. My family has enemies. You don't have the kind of wealth, and let's face it, power that we have, and not have enemies. I've had to fight and claw my way just to stay even with the boys, be the bitch they all call me anyway. And I did it. I kept our money and our name. I kept the two of us together. Her chin goes up. When they call me bitch now, they don't do it to my face. And you think it's someone making a power play through Jeremiah? If they are, it's like nothing I've ever seen. And besides, he's too smart for it. He'd see right through it. Still, he's pretty young. Maybe someone... I let it hang. Eli, I might accept that if it weren't for all the strange stuff. The weird trances he goes into every time the power goes down. Hell, the fact that somehow he had to schedule the power outages. I've already checked with the power company. They've got no idea what's going on. And there's another thing about Jeremiah, something very few people know about. My brother is a certifiable genius. I had his IQ measure once, and it was off the charts. He's going to go places. He's going to change this world. But now... What? I ask. Now he's different. It's almost like he's drugged, except that he's just as sharp as he always is. But distant. He'll stop in the middle of a conversation and just leave. No explanation. He just gets up and gets in his car and leaves. I was frantic. I didn't know what to do. I thought I might find something in his office, and I did. That list. It was only after finding it that I started to correlate his actions with all those time frames, with the power outages. What am I going to do? I've got to find where he's going and why. There's other ways to tell someone, I say. She considers what I said and brightens. Maybe we could put up a camera. Sure we could. I shake my head and hold up my own camera. Already thought of that. This went to sleep, too. Shows him coming up the highway, blinker comes on, and then nothing. Unlike us, it never woke back up. I see her face start to crash and reach over and put a hand on her arm. Hey, Morgan, that's just one way. We could set up after the turnoff and see if he makes a turn. We'd find out that much, at least. But if he's going any distance, we don't have enough time to set up on every side road. The power outages and his little jaunts are all done in another week. I have another idea. One that might work, but I'm going to need your help with it. Anything, she responds. Anything. I look at her and smile. Do you snore? Morgan and I are curled up together, spooning. Midnight plus a few minutes. Part of me considers, okay, fantasizes if this were something else. But in fact, it's the only way we could fit behind the back seat of Jeremiah's SUV. We've been here for half an hour now, and he's due any minute. It's dark back here, made more so by the security cover pulled over us. She said that he always just gets in the car and drives away, that he never checks anything, and he never leaves until the power goes down. I hope she's right. She giggles unexpectedly. What? I whisper. Your breath is tickling the back of my neck. Sorry, I respond. I don't know what else to say. We both stay quiet for a moment. Why me? I finally ask. Truthfully, she responds. One, there aren't a lot of PIs in this town, and your name's Beckett. Yeah. You're the first name in the phone book. For some reason, I'm a bit hurt. That's it? No, actually, I'm kidding, she says. It was your hours. I don't list any hours. No, you didn't. What your ad said was available day or night. And you took a chance I'd be in. She's silent for a long time, and I think she's not going to answer. She shifts slightly, as if uncomfortable, and then clears her throat. Eli, I had you checked out a long time ago. Why? Don't take it personal. There's not a business in this town I haven't had checked out. It's part of the game. Part of surviving in the game. Part of being who I am. Her voice seems abruptly resentful. Rich and powerful Morgan Duquesne, heir to a fortune. Spoiled rich kid. I could say something, probably should say something, but instead I just lie there next to her. Maybe, after all, that's the best thing to do. There's a lamp post next to the car, and the light filters in around the edges of the cover, just enough to let me know the power is still up. She shifts against me, and this surprises me by turning her head and planting a soft kiss on my cheek. Thank you, she says, and I can tell she's close to tears. For what? For believing me, for taking this case. After a moment, I say, you're welcome, and start to say something else when the power goes down. No nap this time. Whatever it is, it's only external to his vehicle. I feel the Humvee turn on to Carpenterville, and we continue for some time. It's a winding road, and it's hard to tell exactly where we are or how long we're on the road. If he turns off without slowing, I'll still think we're on the main road. Hopefully, it won't matter. After a few more turns and bends, he slows, and then the wheels crunch onto a gravel road. Slower now, but still winding. My ears pop. We're putting on elevation. It seems interminable, but it's probably only about 15 or 20 minutes. He slows, makes a sharp left, goes for a ways, and then turns right and comes to a stop. A second later, the engine shuts down. The driver's door opens and closes. I wait, half expecting him to open the back of the car, but his footsteps sound on the gravel, fading away. I quickly reach up and move the security cover back. Morgan and I peek over the back seat at his retreating back. He's wearing light clothing, and he's easy to see in the moonlight. We're in a clearing at the very top of a hill. Any other time, I'd take in the view. The moon is full and hanging just on the horizon over the ocean, reflecting gold all the way to the shore. To the south, I can see the lights of Crescent City. Brookings is completely dark. There's some sort of towers, probably cell phone and a fenced enclosure that must have something to do with the power. There's a generator inside the enclosure. It should be running because of the power outage, but it's not. There's scraggly pine and manzanita, here and there, but mostly it's barren. For the first time, I realize there's a fog bank intersecting the top of the clearing, and Jeremiah is walking directly toward it. Only I realize it's not fog. A fog bank was never that straight and sheer. It's something else. A distortion is all I can think, and I feel the hairs go up on the back of my neck. Whatever it is, it's not natural. Jeremiah walks up to it, and for a moment he's dimly reflected in it. It looks as if he's about to walk into a dusty mirror. His pace doesn't slow at all. Both of us gasp when he walks into it and completely disappears. We both cautiously approach whatever this thing is. I wish there were more cover. It feels too exposed. Up close, it looks more like a dirty window than a mirror. I can see through it and down to the ocean a mile or two down the sloping hillside. It's distorted, that view, and as I look, I realize there's something wrong. The shadows are slightly off, as if there were a representation rather than reality, and that gives me another bad feeling. There's a large diameter cable running from the fenced enclosure into the distortion. In daylight, I think the distortion wouldn't even be noticeable, and if I hadn't been watching her brother walk into it, I never would have even noticed it. What is it? Morgan looks at it, and then me. I pull a small .380 out of my pocket, 6 rounds and one in the pipe. I've never even fired the damn thing. I put it back in my pocket. One way to find out, I say, and step into whatever this thing is, fully expecting to bounce off. There's not even a sense of resistance as I go through. I turn and look back. Morgan is standing on this side, a hand up to her mouth, eyes wide in surprise. She's starting to shake, and I realize that, like Jeremiah, it looks like I must have just disappeared. She has no idea what has happened to me, and I quickly step back through. She starts at my sudden appearance, and I'm afraid she might scream. I put a finger to my lips. I have no idea what that is, but it seems harmless. Maybe you should... She pulls herself together and steps through ahead of me. I follow and start to say something, but then I take in the look on her face. She's staring, mouth open in shock. It feels like my head is turning in slow motion on rusted gears. It's that kind of frightening. When I see what she has seen, it doesn't help my sense of unreality. I take a deep breath. 50 feet in front of us, looking as if Gord himself should come striding down a ramp, is a flying saucer. It sits on the very edge of a long drop-off, looking like a scene from some 50s cheesy science fiction film. I think I'm going to need a raise, I say. Name it, she says, staring at this apparition in front of us. For once in my life, money seems irrelevant. You should go back, I tell her. But she doesn't get a chance to answer. There's a sense of movement, a flash of something pink, and then nothing. Not even the sense of the dark hole that, once again, I seem to have fallen into. I sit up, gingerly holding my head, fighting back a brief moment of nausea. My eyes are shut, concentrating on not throwing up. There's a low ache in my forehead that I try to ignore, and I'm fuzzy and disoriented, not even sure why I'm here at this moment in time. After a moment, the queasiness fades and I look around. Why am I in a forest? Even as I think it, I know it's wrong. Still, it's a logical conclusion, because there seems to be nothing but plants all around me. In fact, I don't even recognize what kind of plants these are. I quickly lose the idea of forest when I realize they're all in pots, and I'm sitting on a hard floor. It doesn't make sense. Morgan's lying beside me, still out. Do you like my plants, Mr. Beckett? I whip my head around. There's a young boy just stepping in between the greenery. But then I realize it's not a boy. Rather, it's a dwarf, or I suppose more properly, a little person. The voice is the giveaway. Not deep, but neither that of a child. And he's stocky. In fact, I'd call him heavy, though it's only a first impression. What he looks like is the world's shortest weightlifter. All of it made ridiculous by a pink dye job on his hair. Then I do a double take. It's not hair. It's feathers. And it's growing not just on his head, but on his shoulders as well. It all comes back to me then. The ride in the back of Jeremiah's car. The power outages. The spaceship sitting behind some sort of cloaking field. My name is Threxen, he says, enunciating each word. Welcome to a little bit of my home world. He makes a sweeping gesture indicating the plants. Don't get too close to that one, he says, pointing. It hasn't been fed all day. Morgan groans and sits up next to me looking around. She looks like she's just had an all-night bender, and in fact suddenly bends as if she might retch. I put a hand on her shoulder to steady her. She's trembling. Or maybe it's my hand. Ah, Miss Duquesne, welcome to my humble abode. Sorry about the means of your entry, but you've both been rather bad, sneaking up here before we're ready for guests. He laughs as if making a joke. I stand up and stare down at him. What's to keep me, I say, from kicking your little alien ass into your little carnivorous rhododendron over there? You could try, he responds, but then I'd have to do this. His hands are a blur, and suddenly he has some sort of weapon pointed directly at my face. Good answer, I respond, not particularly liking how fast he is. Where's my brother? Morgan has stood during my interplay with Threxen. Where's Jeremiah? He glares at her and then turns his attention back to me. You're a rude guest, Mr. Beckett, and not one that I invited anyway. He brings the weapon up to his shoulder, and I have a moment to think, so this is how it is. I try to move, but his finger is already closing on the trigger. I don't even have time to brace myself. A stream of cold water comes out of the weapon and drenches me from head to foot. Threxen throws back his head and laughs, an odd adult sound from that small body. It occurs to me that I don't like him. Oh, Mr. Beckett, the look on your face, that's about the funniest thing I've seen since I've been on this little backwater of a planet. He holds up the water gun. This is a watering device for my plants, nothing more. He hands it to me and I dumbly take it. Maybe, he says, you could be trainable as a gardener. That's it. It feels like metal and it's heavier than it looks. I grab it by the barrel and swing it as hard as I can for his stupid little feathered head. prepare to return to orbit, I think, waiting for the solid connect. Except that he's moved, damn fast, and my swing takes me around on my feet and I crash to the ground. The watering gun goes flying, clattering across the floor between the pots. He looks at me and sighs. You really are a very unimpressive species. My planet has about twice the gravity of yours, Mr. Beckett. I'm faster and stronger. I could tear you apart like a wishbone if I desired. Enough of this nonsense. Come with me, he says, and pushes his way through the plants. I stand and look at Morgan, putting a hand in my pocket and firmly grasping the little pistol. When I nod at you, distract him in some way, I whisper. She nods. Turning, we both follow our host. Morgan is sobbing on my shoulder, with good cause. Her brother is sitting in a chair looking at us, or more aptly through us. There's a large machine next to the chair he's sitting in. An open panel allows a number of cords to come out of it. One of them snakes up the side of his chair and into some type of circuit board. The circuit board is molded to the side of Jeremiah's face. He seems as aware of it as he is of us, which is to say, not at all. What have you done to him? She sobs, pulling her head away from my shoulder and staring first at her brother and then at Threxen. She starts to pull away from me, but I hold her back. I can sense the anger growing inside her. Oh, not to worry, Miss Duquesne. He's quite all right, but we prefer a docile unit for our interface. We? I ask. Threxen walks over to Jeremiah and inspects the cable coming out of the machine. Well, I suppose at this point in time it's more of a me. I'm just a scout. The rest will come when I report back. He turns and faces us. You see, my race are essentially miners. Uh-huh, I say. Mining for what? Everything. You see, we depleted our planet a long time ago and had to turn to other resources. We soon discovered that mining was a tedious affair. Some centuries back, we decided it would be a lot easier if we had someone do the mining for us. I'm not following, I said, though I began to get an uncomfortable inkling. It's simple, really, said Threxen, as he makes an adjustment on the machine with the cables running out of it. Any planet with a sizable civilization always develops an electrical grid. That grid can carry a signal, one that, with time, can be tuned to the brains of the inhabitants of that planet. A controlling signal. Ah, I see that's starting to become more clear to you. Yeah, I respond, real clear. You turn us all into robots to do your bidding. Very good, Mr. Beckett. Not all that easy, however. Finding someone with the intellect to be a reliable interface was the difficult part. You aren't the brightest species in the galaxy, after all. But I persevered, and now, with his brain almost at the interface point, he nods towards Jeremiah, you'll soon all turn away from all your own silliness and work for us. After a time, others of my kind will come and pick up the product and be on our way. I look hard at him, and we're left to rebuild our civilization without raw materials. Threxen laughs again. Oh, I think you've misunderstood the last part. We would never be so stupid as to leave witnesses behind. What we do, well, let's say the rest of the galactic civilization frowns on. No, when we're all done, several of your leaders will suddenly decide that a nuclear war would be a great idea. He makes an upward sweeping gesture with his hands. Poof, problem solved. I push Morgan away from me and have the 380 out and firing before I'm even aware of what I'm going to do. The first round catches him in the shoulder and spins him around. The second one doesn't even go off. My wrist is suddenly twisted at a painful angle, and the gun is in his hand and pointed at me. He steps in front of me and plants a haymaker into my gut. I go to my knees and find myself face to face with him. He puts the gun up to my forehead. He looks really, really angry. A very thin, pink-colored blood is oozing out of the hole in his shoulder. That, he said, hurts. And just like your species, we don't like pain. Goodbye, Mr. Beckett. I think we can do with one less worker. He smiles as his finger begins to tighten on the trigger. The butt of the watering gun impacts his head and the 380 is raked across my forehead, leaving a long gouge. The sound of it going off next to my ear is loud, and I kiss hearing from that ear goodbye for about 24 hours. Morgan stands behind him, winding up for another home run with the watering gun. Now it's him on his knees, but he's not out. Already he's turning around to face Morgan, and the rage I see in his face does not bode well for either one of us. My wrist is a throbbing agony, and blood from the gouge on my forehead is leaking down into my eyes. Add to that that I'm still trying to draw a decent breath from the haymaker, and you get an idea of why this isn't a particularly good moment for me. She swings again and catches him a glancing blow. He shakes it off and stands. In a moment he'll be on her, and I know how that's going to end. I grab a handful of pink feathers in my bad hand, wincing as I feel the bones in my wrist grind. Green stick fracture, a part of my mind supplies, but the rest of my body is doing a mining job of its own. Adrenaline pumps through me. I grab one of his legs and stand, powerlifting him above my head. He's heavy, really heavy, and now that I'm standing, I know I'm not going to be holding him up for very long. What to do? I heave him into the open machinery next to where Jeremiah is sitting. There's an arc, like a welding rod hitting metal, and a screech like, well, a really loud screech. He begins to jitter and shake inside the opening as sparks fly out. The pink feathers on his head catch fire. The smell is unbelievable. More so is the fact that he's still alive. His hands grasp at the side of the machine, and he slowly begins to push back out. Morgan, I yell, and point at the watering gun in her hands and to where he is slowly extricating himself. She smiles and sends a long stream of water into the open cavity of the machine. Some sort of klaxon begins to sound in the ship. Smoke bellows out of the machine, along with the smell of burning feathers and alien flesh. Sparks are a continuous shower, and Threxen's screams match the klaxon in intensity. There's movement in the smoke, and suddenly Jeremiah stands. The cable leading to the device on the side of his head is melted. The circuit board clatters to the floor, unheard over the din. He takes a stumbling step, and Morgan catches him. He looks at her, dazed. What's going on? He asks, and looks around, and I see a sense of confusion on his face, as well as a sense of recognition. I realize that for some time there's been a vibration coming up from under my feet, cycling up and getting stronger and stronger. Morgan, I yell, it's powering up. We've got to get out of here. I have no idea where the exit is. Jeremiah takes a deep breath and stands on his own. This way, he says, and stumbling slightly leads us to a blank spot on the wall. I look at him, questioning, and his hand shoots out and hits a blank plate. It lights up, and suddenly there's a door in front of us and a ramp leading down to the ground. As I watch, it's already starting to pull in. Now I yell and push them ahead of me and out onto the ramp. I look back once when I gain the ramp. Amazingly, Threxen is still alive and is pulling himself out of the machinery. Then the door slams shut, the ramp pulls suddenly into the side of the ship, and we're all dropped onto the ground beside it. I land on my bad wrist and raise the pay grade of my green stick fracture as I pass out. When I've come to, they drag me to the Hummer and I'm sitting in the driver's seat. Morgan sits in the passenger seat. She looks relieved when I focus on her. Oh God, she says, I thought you might be dying. Whatever the distortion was, it's gone. The ship is humming loudly now, starting to glow. Morgan looks at me with desperate eyes. She sounds defeated. He's getting away, she says. I groan and gingerly cradle my wrist. I think of my planet used and discarded, of the loss of all that we are, of my past and how self-centered I've been, of how little I actually contributed in life. A rage overtakes me. Not on my watch, I say between clenched teeth. I turn the ignition over on the Hummer. What the hell are you doing? She yells. Buckle up, I yell. It's going to get bumpy. I slam it into gear and hit the accelerator. Are you insane? She shouts, staring at me. I laugh as we speed forward and think maybe I am. Insane and pissed. The Hummer slammed into the side of the ship, crumpling the car's front end and exploding the airbags. The ship rings like a bell, and much to my surprise, it moves a couple of feet towards the very edge of the precipice. I didn't really expect it to work. I just wanted to hit something. A voice comes over the radio. Our sensors indicate you've been in a crash. I am calling emergency services. Call the National Guard while you're at it, I yell, slamming it into reverse. I back up about 20 feet behind where we were originally parked. I turn and look at Morgan. She's a mess, bruised, covered in smoke, and a wild look in her eyes. She's never been more beautiful. She surprises me, leans over and plants a lip locker on me that I don't think I'll ever forget. Hit him again, Eli, she yells, and I slam it into drive. I give it all it's got, and we bang into Threxen's ship one more time. The Hummer's engine makes a single clunk and dies as a big cloud of steam rises from the hood. When it clears, I can see the side of the ship in front of us, but not for long. Slowly, almost majestically, it tilts. The front bumper of the Hummer gets caught on a projection on the side of the ship, and suddenly we're being pulled forward. Uh-oh, unbuckle, I yell, but it's too late. The front of the Hummer goes over the edge, and then, abruptly, the bumper rips loose. A brief moment where we see the underside of the spaceship sliding down in front of us, and then nothing but a moonlit night. The Hummer pops and cracks, almost tilting. I feel my vision going fuzzy at the edges. Morgan unbuckles her seatbelt as well as mine and then scrambles into the back seat. She and Jeremiah pull me back with them. The frame of the Hummer is buckled and the side doors won't open. Morgan leans back over the front seat and hits a button. The Hummer begins a sickening lurch forward and she quickly sits back down. Behind us, the hatchback creaks and pops open about 2 inches. Now Jeremiah climbs over the back seat and begins kicking it. The Hummer begins to scrape on the edge of the cliff, moving forward. It's all like a dream to me. Suddenly, the back door pops open. Jeremiah and Morgan grab me, pull me over the seat, and we spill out onto the ground. The Hummer tilts forward, the rear wheels coming up off the ground, and then stops. Jeremiah stands up and walks to the front of the vehicle. "Huh," he says. "The front end's caught on that cable from the power company." He looks at us and smiles. "We were never in any danger." There's a sudden snap, and the cable releases from whatever held it back in the power enclosure. The Hummer tilts the rest of the way up, and then slides over the side of the cliff. Jeremiah looks like a flamenco dancer for a moment, as he avoids the cable that whips through his legs. "Ole," I say weakly. "The ship," says Morgan. "I didn't hear it crash. Please tell me it crashed." Jeremiah leans nervously over the edge of the precipice, and his face is bathed in a glowing light. Through the stillness comes a powerful hum, raising in intensity. Stronger and stronger, and then it rises in front of us, slowly coming even with the edge of the cliff, and then rising more, accelerating, the sound going from a hum to a roar. Rising and rising, glowing in the night like some reverse meteor. Now the size of a house, now a car, now no bigger than a bird. The sound of its passage, a screaming of wind as it moves faster and faster. "We lost," says Morgan, and sits down hard on the ground. She looks up, eyes wet with tears. "He'll be back, and there's nothing we can do about it." Its glow is almost lost against the night sky now, just another star in the heavens, fading like our hope. It winks once, like a twinkle of a star, and just before it disappears from sight altogether, it goes nova. For a brief moment, the sky is as bright as a sunlit day at noon. Pieces of metal moving supersonic spread out across the sky, as if God herself had decided to show us how fireworks were supposed to be done. The shock wave washes over us less than a minute later. Slowly, slowly, the glow fades. There are thumps here and there as chunks of metal, small and large, begin to rain down. We sit there for a long time under the wheeling night sky. Just as the ambulance pulls up to where we sit in the dirt, a lone pink feather drifts down to land in front of me. I throw back my head and laugh, and then pass out for good. Drunken rich kid's car crashes off cliff was a much more believable headline and the story we all agreed to stick with. My sole mention in the article was that of being a business associate, and perhaps that's all I ever was. That kiss in the car, likely nothing more than the heat of the moment. Call it traveling expenses. A real check, for an amount much more than what she agreed to pay me, showed up in the mail a few days later. Case closed. I guess she's got her circles, and I've got mine. Really, what did I expect? Paco never told me about this part of it, that I could decide to accept or refuse what's inside me. California is no longer a state of mind. It's just a state. I'll visit sometime if I want, but for now, this is home. In spite of the colder weather and the rain, I open my window to look down on the avenue again. Another late night and no traffic. The rain makes blurry cones of light all up and down the street. The air is fresh and clean, and I take a deep breath. In the distance, a car. A sleek, expensive shape. A low, purring growl. The kind that only money can afford. Slowing, and then pulling over to stop. The gentle tap of high heels, and a dress so blue it's almost black. A subtle scent that comes all the way up to my window, and I think of the future. The weather vane turns and a breeze cools the harbor. All is as it should be. Tonight's story, Eli Beckett, The Case of the Missing Brother, was written, produced, and read by Dan Gray. Music provided by Zapsplat.com.